I am Planta on the Line. This is the commentary.ca. A couple of years ago, in a series of pieces in the Globe and Mail, my guest now, Ian Brown, wrote about his son, Walker, who suffers from a rare genetic mutation. It's so rare that only 100 or so people in the world suffer from it. It's called cardiofaciocutaneous syndrome, CFC. Walker is delayed in development, and he has to wear cuffs on his arms as he constantly hits himself. And at night, someone has to sleep with Walker to calm him and to make sure he doesn't hurt himself. Amidst the turmoil to Walker and his family, something deeper, thoughtful, and marvelous is revealed, not only about Walker, but his father. I am sure the reader will find something profound to take away from this book. The book is called The Boy in the Moon, A Father's Search for His Disabled Son. It's published by Random House. It breaks your heart as well as lifts your spirits, this book. Ian Brown is a feature writer at the Globe and Mail and anchors two documentary programs on TVO, Human Edge and The View from Here. He was the host of that CBC radio program, Talking Books. He's written two previous books here in Vancouver this day. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program, Ian Brown. Good morning, Mr. Brown.
Good morning.
What is the name of this genetic condition? How do you pronounce it?
It's cardio for the heart problems it causes, facio for the facial dysmorphia, that it the sort of disfigurement in the face. Kids tend to have no eyebrows. That's actually one of the most salient. That's how they spot it. Lower and rotated ears, sort of a crinkled bridge on their nose, you know, down slanted eyes, etc. That's the facio. And then cutaneous pertains to their skin, which tends to be dry and very, very sensitive. One of the symptoms of the syndrome is a real allergy to new stimuli. If you touch these kids, they freak out. And if new noises, new stuff like that freaks out, at least when they're very, very young. I think it has to do with the wiring in the brain is not complete, and so any new information causes a kind of information overload. So that's how you get cardiofaciocutaneous.
It made me laugh out loud when you described what he looked like. Hey, you described him as looking like Frank Sinatra Jr.
Yes, well, when he's happy, he looks like Frank Sinatra Jr. on a tear. You know, so he's got a kind of, hey, you know, he used to make a noise that was, he'd made various noises over the years, but one of them was rah, 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 rah. And when he was in the Frank Sinatra Jr. mode, he would do the rah, 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 rah. He was, my wife actually took a photograph of him once, and he looked like Robert Evans, you know, the producer, the
right.
Famous producer who knew Natalie Wood and photographer. He was always talking like this, the whole kind of thing. And Walker had I once put my sunglasses on and we took some photographs of him. In fact, there's a picture in the book of that.
Right.
And he almost became the Robert Evans of the CFC crowd. And he was, you know, I think we did those things, I mean, obviously not to make fun of him, but because you spend so much time feeling guilty, needlessly and pointlessly, because, of course, you know, we didn't cause this thing. It was a genetic mutation. And you spend so much time behind what my wife used to call the soundproof curtain of disability, where you just can't communicate it, that the chance to have fun and to, you know, be in a situation where we were laughing that any family might have, that meant a lot to us.
There's one thing that I take exception in the book. You killed Robert Evans. He's still with us.
Oh, did I? Did I say he was? He died?
Yeah, you mentioned that he's the late Robert Evans.
But are you sure he didn't die?
No, he had a stroke, I think.
Yeah, he had a stroke, but did he not die after that?
No, he's still alive. I checked Wikipedia and other places, and he's still with us.
Well, I'm sorry. Then that is that's inaccurate. I didn't mean to imply. I'll fix that if the next chance I get. I was sure he passed away, but
yeah.
Maybe I offed him too quickly. I'm sorry.
You'll have to ask your wife. She's the noted writer Johanna Schellner, right?
Johanna Schneller.
Johanna Schneller,
yes.
Pardon me.
Yes.
I've long enjoyed her work. How did she feel about you writing about Walker and your life?
I think she encouraged it. You know, I began writing about it because it was a way for me to... I'm a you know, note taker and a journal keeper. And I always, if something's bothering me, I always write it down and write about it. And that's how I get back close to normal anyway. And when Walker caused considerable anxiety in our lives from the moment he was born, and I started keeping notes in a journal about it. And when I was about, he was about three, I guess, I was actually skiing on the Illicillewit Glacier, not too far, well, in Rogers Pass, which is in B.C., and a friend of mine said, you know, you should write about this because you talk about it and you seem interested in it and your enthusiasm is infectious. And he said, you know, and when you're talking about it, it's not about a disabled kid. To me, it feels like you're talking about life and how you approach, how you break out of cliche and how you break out of sameness. And so you should write about it. And so I started to. And Johanna was, you know, she was always very enthusiastic about it. She's always, you know, sometimes I think she wondered whether I was being too candid, but I mean, she, you know, she read the book and she was utterly enthusiastic about it. And you know, this, I could have been, I guess, much more candid, or been more. I try not to be confessional, but to be candid instead, and to manage a little bit of candor as well as I could. And I think she, I don't know. You know, he can't speak, so he has no voice, but he has a point of view. And finding his point of view, letting his point of view come to me as opposed to trying to, you know, ambitiously get to it, has been an interesting, almost artistic process for me and for him, you know. And I wanted to find his voice to let people know that there was one there, that this disabled boy was not frightening, that one didn't have to be frightened by him, that disability or intellectual disability actually, that there was way more there than even I realized. And so writing it was allowed us to do that. And in many ways, Johanna is the co-author, because at many points in the book, you know, I recount conversations we've had late at night as we're, you know, talking, or arguments we had, or debates we had, you know, about whether he should go to an assisted living home or not. So in many ways, she's the co-author of it.
There's a lovely scene in the book where you're at a function and she's at the bar with a friend of yours, and they look like they're flirting, and you're just beside yourself and jealous, I guess, right?
Well, I was. It wasn't that they seemed to be flirting. They were flirting.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about it. But I don't. I am capable of jealousy, but at that time, it was so demanding to raise Walker, and Johanna did so much of it. You know, she's very, or she figured out to have a laundry hamper full of toys on every floor, so we didn't have to run up and down. You know, she would keep track of which appointments were when, and then we would share the getting him to and from them. You know, that can really be hard on a relationship, because you give so much just in the sheer maintenance of a disabled kid's life that you don't have much time for the value-added extras that keep a relationship in good nick, you know. Like, you know, it helps once in a while to come home with a bunch of flowers for the woman you live with and say, you know, these are for you, and they'll make the house pretty, and they'll reflect you, or something. I mean, you should do that. You really should do that once in a while. But with Walker, I was so exhausted most of the time, it just wasn't that much flexibility left, and the same for her. So when I did see her, it was at a Christmas party, and I was talking to some people about, you know, I'm a journalist, and I don't know what we were talking about, religious fundamentalism or something like that. But what I was really doing was doing what a lot of husbands do, which is quietly watching their wives. And I watched her across that room, and I saw her at the bar with this guy, shoulder to shoulder. And, you know, I know him, and I know he's very fond of her. You know, in fact, so fond. I once asked him if he was in love with her. and he said, oh, yes, I love you. Well, in a way that's a problem. And he said, no, not in a way that's a problem. And I said, well, you sort of crush away, you know. I mean, I can't deny my wife who did so much for this, but not only for him, but for our other daughter who is a, you know, normal and lovely person. But I just couldn't deny her that. It changed the way I saw jealousy, I guess. Maybe that sounds ridiculous, but, you know, Walker made me think in unconventional ways about many, many aspects of conventional life that have nothing to do with disability. And it was partly that I wanted to write about.
You write in the book that soon after he was born and he had this condition, you viewed it as your comeuppance. Why? What had you done previous?
Well, you know, I was your standard callow jackass. I didn't marry till I was 30. I met my wife when I was 34, 35. I didn't marry till I was 39. I was, you know, quite driven, and still am in many ways. You know, wanted to be a writer and subjugated everything to that. When I was single, I used to go eat in restaurants, and I would see couples sitting at a table in total silence, doing nothing but eating their food, not talking. And I would think, why would you do that? I mean, why have a relationship that incarcerates you? So I didn't understand that. And later, when I got married, I would see people with children, and I would think, oh, wow, you know, that's a lot of work. And then, of course, I had a child of my own, my daughter Haley, and I would see couples with disabled children, and I would think, you know, that looks like hell. It wasn't that I didn't sympathize, but you know, that's got to be the greatest agony there ever was. So, of course, you know, my second child is a disabled child. You know, that's what I mean by comeuppance. That if I had that not happened, none of what, you know, I mean, if there'd been a test for what Walker has, and it showed up when Johanna was pregnant, we probably, you know, before we knew him, before we knew who he was, before we understood the color and shape and quality of his humanity, we probably would have had an abortion. And I wouldn't be the person I am today because of that. So, and that in turn makes you, you know, have very complex thoughts about, I mean, I wouldn't wish a severe disability on anybody, but I also know what the value of severe disability is. So my reactions to those sorts of things are much less cut and dry than they would have been. So the comeuppance has also, you know, it's had its virtues.
And once he was born, how often did you actually consider suicide?
Once he was born, how often did I consider suicide?
Yeah, and taking him with you at some point too, as well, right?
Yeah, I used to think that when it was really bad, you know, when I mean, you have to understand, you know, he couldn't pee on his own. You know, that felt like a failure, rationally or not. I couldn't, you know, there was no time to complete a project. Our financial situation was deteriorating. My marriage was going down. I didn't know if I could ever afford university for my daughter. You know, it was pretty bad, And I used to sometimes think, well, I've got insurance, you know, I could take Walker with me, I could go glacier skiing, I could ski mountaineering, I could, you know, very easily just drop off somewhere, lie down on a snowbank. The problem was that to get there, I'd have to organize all the paraphernalia, crap and corruption that you have to take with you ski mountaineering's bad enough. You know, Walker stuff on top of that, the very thought of getting through the airport security with all that stuff. You know, Nietzsche used to say, you know, the thought of suicide has saved many a life. Well, you know, that process, the very thought of getting to the airport with him, I thought, well, this is easier than that. But when you say how often?
Yeah.
I'm not trying to exaggerate, but every night that I was up with him, after 2 hours of being pretty tired, I'd say the thought occurred to me every day. I mean, I'm not saying I wanted to act on it every day, but it occurred to me every day. You see, the problem is that it's not just that you need to find a way for him to live. You need to find social assistance. You need to find a place for him to live, which I looked for. needed to find a community or a place where he can live after I'm gone that will feel like his place, where the residents have an inner life that is reflected in the home, you know, a real home as opposed to just a professional home. In addition to all of that, you really have to figure out a way to deal with it. You have to figure out what the value of his life is and what the value of your life is, since it is so far off the normal skew. But once you figure that out, or once you begin to realize that the way through it is in it, I mean, the way through it is by living it, by stopping and saying, you know, I don't have to be, like, this doesn't have to have an outcome that one can measure and quantify. It doesn't have to have an outcome that has, you know, a dollar sign beside it. It doesn't even have to have an outcome that has a successful communicational experiment. You know, it doesn't have to be religious where you say, oh, he's a little angel, he's my gift, and none of that. All you have to do is be in it and be alert and pay attention. And in a funny way, that becomes its own reward. It becomes its own, because it allows you to break. You know, Hemingway once said that the hardest thing in writing is to know what is actually true, and to be able to distinguish that from what you think is supposed to be true, what other people tell you is true, what you want to be true so that you will be seen to be a genius, or, you know, whatever the orthodoxies of your age are. And being with Walker allowed me to feel physically what was true, as opposed to all those shoulds and could be's and woulds. And that's an important thing, not just, you know, when you're figuring out how to deal with people with disabilities, not just as an individual, but as a society, to get away from these ideologies and figure out something, you know, to create communities for them. But it's important, even if you don't have kids, never mind if you don't have disabled kids, it's an important thing to understand as a human being in the modern technological world. So those were I can't even remember what your question was at the beginning, but I hope it's still related.
Absolutely it is, yeah. Walker was born, I guess, 13 years ago. He's 13 now. Does science know anything more about this condition?
They have details. The geneticists have found genes that seem to be associated with the syndrome. But there are many more genes that they haven't discovered that they think will turn out to be associated with it. That doesn't mean the genes necessarily cause the syndrome, because while the shape of the human genome turns out to have been simpler than we thought, the way it operates is way more complex than anybody anticipated. So we know that it may be related to serotonin uptake, that kids who have disfigured faces seem to also have faulty serotonin, that they have difficulty feeling pleasure. It used to be thought that, you know, they cried a lot because they weren't accepted and they could feel it, but it seems to be more chemical than that. They think that part of the problem may be that in the neurochemistry of children with this syndrome, they think that actually the stuff that goes wrong in a CSC kid, basically there are these ways of transmitting messages within cells. If a message comes up to the wall of a cell and says, okay, make more of this, and then the message gets transferred down to the nucleus. Well, the genes that are associated with CFC interrupt the communication between the inner side of the cell wall and the nucleus. And instead of saying, make more of this or don't make more of this, it says the opposite. And that's why they have less developed brains than they should, but they have overdeveloped, skin cells, for instance, or overdeveloped heart cells. So they know all sorts of stuff about that, but the problem with understanding a human being from the bottom up like that is it doesn't give you any sense of the human being. What they can't explain is is how it is possible to connect with Walker emotionally and physically in a way that even he understands, even though there are no formal, there's no formal language and there's no formal visuals and there's no formal audio. You see? So, I met a very interesting geneticist in Oxford, and I said to him, do you think, like, Walker's genes are screwed up? Does that mean his mind is screwed up? And this geneticist, who's really on the cutting edge of these things, he said, well, you know, the mind probably does not exist inside the brain. The mind, as we know it, you know, the mind that says, I want to do this, I want to do something, or that has intentions, or that has reactions, that probably exists in the neural pathways that are set up between people in society. That's where the mind probably exists. Now, the traditional understanding of Walker is that he doesn't have a mind. But he actually made me realize that in a kind of instinctual sense, that actually may have a scientific understanding. So, you know, we may discover that these children, or these people, they have a lot to tell us. But to understand them, we have to approach them in a different way. We have to stop saying, they can't count, they can't speak, they can't do this, they can't operate in the way normal, quote, children do. They operate, you know, they may operate better in segregated communities where they're the boss, as opposed to inclusive communities where we're trying to make them adapt to us. We may discover there's all kinds of things they can tell us about human nature and the way the mind operates, the way the human being operates. But we've got to stop thinking of them as incomplete or failed. It was by being with Walker that I began to see those possibilities. I'm sorry, I keep rambling on these terrible long answers to your great questions. As you can see, I can't stop talking about it.
This is fascinating, Ian. I wanted to ask about something that happened at your house. Olga, who cared for Walker.
Who is his nanny. Yeah.
Right. She'd keep these pop can lids. Now, I actually read her with interest because my parents are Filipino and my mom's a nurse.
Oh, yeah.
So I noticed her right away. Well, what was the deal with the pop can lids? The tabs, I guess. When you open a pop can, that's what opens it up, I guess.
Well, I don't know. You open the lid, and then and Olga would always break them off. And I think it was maybe because Walker played with them, and they broke off. And so she would save them because, you know, she is, as a Filipina, you know, she's incredibly economizing. She saves everything. She'll save rubber bands. She'll save those little plastic things that come around a bread bag.
Right.
And they always come in handy. And I thought, well, she's obviously saving them and she's going to recycle them, or maybe there's some way some guy comes by and they get money for it. I don't know. And she would put them in these plastic bags. And I think one day Walker opened the drawer and pulled out this bag of pop can tabs and started rolling it in his hand. And he loves to do this. I mean, he can do that several hundred times, you know, an hour. And he walks around and he inspects things, but it gives him something to do. And it was interesting to me because, you know, this is what I mean about stopping and thinking, because he makes me stop and think. I thought, well, what is that? So I would pick up his bag and I would roll it. And the plastic is soft, but the pop can tabs are sharp. So what you get is this sharpness through the softness. And I immediately thought, I mean, you know, this is not going to make me sound all that normal, but I did immediately think of John Keats, the poet. And I thought, you know, this is what Keats talked about when he talked about negative capabilities. You know, that instead of thinking about a problem and immediately finding the answer, right, you know, snapping to the answer, getting to the solution, what Keats liked to do, I think there's a movie out about Keats right now that actually talks about this kind of thing. That Jane Campion made, although I can't remember the name of it. But Keats said the trick is to keep all the questions and all the possible answers in your mind at the same time. And in that way, you access the more mysterious and interesting answer, as opposed to the I have a solution answer, you know, the sort of look sharp, feel sharp, find your head to a point answer. And I think maybe Walker's physical version of negative capability, these contradictions, keeping contradictions in your head at the same time without having a, you know, without freaking out, is this business of the sharpness under the softness. And of course, I'm not saying Walker has a notion of negative capability and he thinks negative capability, we just can't say it, but he feels it, and he conveyed it, at least he made me think about it when I picked up the bag and felt it for myself. I thought, well, that maybe that's what he's feeling. Maybe that's why it's so interesting. I mean, it is a really cool thing to think. It's sort of like the, you know, the writer Nick Baker once he said, you know how cool it is to write in ballpoint pen on the tips of your, on the toes of your sneakers, right? You know, that wonderful flow of ballpoint pen ink on rubber. It goes on so smoothly. Well, I think Walker has the same kind of experience with that pop can baggy thing. And it made me think. So that's what I mean about, you see, that's how, in a way, the mind exists outside of the mind. Walker picks up the bag full of pop cans. He plays with it. I say, I wonder what that's all about. I play with it. I think Keats. I go back to Walker. You see what I mean?
It all makes sense, yeah.
I think it makes sense. It may be that that Walker is now smarter than I am. I keep thinking this way, but he sure seems interesting.
And where's Walker today?
Well, Walker is in Toronto at the moment. He would be at school right now. He was just with us on Saturday. I took him out to my dad's place to see my dad on Saturday. He's 95, and he and Walker have a real non-speaking, like they're the only people I know. Walker will walk up to my dad, and my dad will say, hello, Snodgrass, or whatever. He's British, and he does that kind of thing. And Walker and they will stand and look at each other for about 5 minutes, smiling, and then Walker will climb into his lap and sit there for 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And for Walker, that's like going to graduate school and spending 10 years writing a PhD thesis. I mean, he just does not have that staying power. But with my old man, he does. And anyway, he was there, so now he's back in his other home, and he's at school, and he will probably, he'll probably come home on, let's see, what's today, Monday. He'll probably be home on Friday, because we haven't seen him in a bit, so, because I have to be away for a while.
And do you sort of begrudge that he's got his own life now?
I do, a little bit. I don't begrudge it now. At the beginning, when I first moved into the other house, I really begrudged it. And, you know, I lost all my rhythms. I lost I forgot how it was to sleep with him. And I would bring him back so that I could go through it again. I mean, I would go bring him back so that I could spend a sleepless night with him, because those sleepless nights, you know, they took me to places I never expected to go, and I wanted to go back to those places, and make sure I remembered them, got the details right. And not just to write the book, I mean, to live. And, I guess, although, I have to say, he doesn't at the moment, but before he went to this new house, he was in another house. Like, it's all part of the same organization. And he had a girlfriend. He actually had a girlfriend. And she was a bit older. She was an older woman,
Mm-hmm.
And she was cute. I mean, she was 15. Her name was Krista Lee. A lovely girl. Lovely person. She could talk, but she was in a wheelchair. And a motorized wheelchair. And Walker used to come up, he would sort of set the wheelchair moving, and she would say, Walker, what are you doing? And he could not reply, but he provided her with, he adored her, because she could talk, and he loved to listen to her talk. And he would provide her with what she did not have, which was an audience and attention. And, I really think it was a love affair. And at first, I thought, they're just pals, but when Walker left the house, they didn't tell Krista Lee that he was leaving till the very last day, because they knew she'd be so upset.
Right.
And, I remember the first time a geneticist, that we met a geneticist, and he said, well, you know, we don't know much about it, but by the time, and we, you know, Walker has a 50% chance of having a CFC kid of his own, and, but of course, by the time he's old enough to marry, we'll know much more about it. Well, you know, they don't know much more about it. And at the time, I thought to myself, well, Walker married? Come on, you know, give me a break. But, you know, now, I think, well, why not? I mean, he has so few connections because of his disability. Why, if there is somebody who wants to share his life, who am I to deny that to him? And, you know, and while it would, you know, it would give me enormous pleasure if he'd date a girl and stay out late and forget to call me so I could get mad at him and ground him. You know, I'd love to be able to ground Walker, you know, if he could do something bad like that. But, I don't know, I used to have this dream. And this dream, he was saying goodbye to me at the door of his house. And he was happy. And he was reassuring me. You know, he had a girl beside him and a girl on the other side of him. I mean, I have to admit, in my Ben is a bit of a player, you know. and he is surprisingly charming. I mean, you know, he is the only guy I know who will walk into, and he'll climb up into a girl's lap, a woman's lap, and she will let him. He will play with her bracelet, and then he will sort of look down her blouse.
Yeah.
And she will let him do that. You know, and it's not offended. And I will say afterwards, I'll tell him, you know, he's disabled. And he goes, no. And they'll say, no. That was very intentional on his part. You know, he knows what he's doing. But in this dream, you know, he's there with the girls, and he has found a girlfriend. He's found somebody to love. And somebody to love him. And not just in the way that everybody loves Walker, because he exudes his desire to be with you. And people can't help but in some ways love him back, or maybe it's not love, maybe it's, but they want to, he makes these connections. But in the dream, it's specific to him. Like, he's loving them and they are loving him. It's his own private thing. He has a private life, as opposed to this life that he lives as a disabled person, which is perforce almost public in every way. And in my dream, he's happy, and he's giving me his blessing. He's saying, it's okay, Dad. I forgive you. You did not cause this. It's all right. And it's one of the, you know, Johanna dreams that he's talking like a lawyer. Haley dreams that he's, you know, that he's debating. I dream that he's waving goodbye to me at the door of his house and blessing me. And I want to believe it's true, you know. But I mean, it is a dream, you know. I fear it is only a dream. That is my fear that it. But you know, as I fear that I cannot leave him. He will. But you know, he is always my leader and my master in these things. You know, he will show me when it is right to say it's okay, Dad. I mean, he is already doing that. You know, he ushered me out of his house when we got home the other day. I dropped him off. He's going, oh, bye. You know, I got something to do. He's pushing me towards the door. So he's already ahead of me on that.
Ian, this has been just a fascinating conversation, and man, just a wonderful book. Congratulations and continued good luck with it.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate all your interest.
The book is called The Boy in the Moon, A Father's Search for His Disabled Son. It's published by Random House. The author, Ian Brown, on the line in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunta.